Hi, Sandy.
Hi, it's good to hear from you.
Yes, and I think the audience should probably know that you and I are old friends, and even though we are sometimes adversaries, we both are sort of members of each other's fan clubs, I think.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right.
So we're supposed to introduce ourselves, and I'm Randy Barnett from Georgetown Law School, and you are?
I'm Sandy Levinson from the University of Texas Law School and Government Department.
So, Sandy, lots of has happened on the constitutional scene, and one of the things that I think is the most exciting development that's gone on in a very long time is this Tea Party movement. So I was wondering what your impressions of the Tea Party were, and whether you've had any contact with them yourself.
As to the latter, if I've had contact, it's been indirect, though I did participate on September 17th in a very interesting program sponsored by Hillsdale College. And I think it's fair to say that a lot of people in that audience are very sympathetic to the Tea Party. I guess I should say I'm wildly ambivalent about the Tea Party. That is, their politics generally could not be more distant from mine. That being said, there are certain aspects about the Tea Party I actually admire, one of which, ironically enough, is their recognition that there's actually a connection between the Constitution and their political ends. Because one of the complaints I have with a lot of people on the left these days with whom I identify is that there's all sorts of griping about American politics, but no recognition that says anything, that American politics really has anything to do with the structures that the Constitution has set out. And certainly a number of Tea Party folk do have that recognition, and I applaud them for doing that.
Yeah, I've probably had more contact with the Tea Party than you have.
No doubt.
I've been to a couple Tea Party get-togethers, including the big one that was held on the weekend before the health care bill passed here in D.C., and I've done some advising or counseling of Tea Party groups, and much of what the Tea Party does, they do by conference call. In fact, just as the fax machine might be what was responsible in part for bringing down the Iron Curtain, the free conference call may be what's responsible for the rise of the Tea Party, because they do an awful lot of their decision-making by consensus, and I've been involved in a couple of conference calls on different subjects, and it's been very interesting because I've been really impressed with the quality of the conversation, and these were local leaders of different Tea Party chapters. So here's how I view them. I view them as kind of a small L libertarian movement, located generally on the right, but really including a lot of people that we would normally think of as independents or even sometimes moderates. And it's basically organized around two concerns. One is fiscal, spending, bankruptcy, the future of the country and the future of their children's financial well-being. And the other is federal power, governmental power, and whether the federal government is acting within its constitutional constraints. So those are the two things. And what doesn't seem to be animating the Tea Party as a movement is the social issues that are used so often by people on the left and the right to as wedge issues to kind of divide the other side's coalition. And that, even though I'm sure there's a lot of Tea Party members who share a lot of social conservative views, that isn't really what the Tea Party itself is about. Does that square with your impressions of the Tea Party, do you think?
It's not wildly off. I certainly do have the feeling that the central focus is on the federal government on a rampage and the need to restore a certain vision of federalism. Now, you know, where you and I disagree most strongly is whether the federal government can be described as on a rampage, either as a constitutional matter or as a political matter. But to go back to what I was saying a few moments ago, I think that in as much, say, as the Tea Party, or some people in the Tea Party, because certainly in the state to believe that everything in the Tea Party is the same, insofar as some people in the Tea Party are calling for the repeal of the 17th Amendment, although I oppose that, what I actually applaud is the recognition that the 17th Amendment was profoundly important with regard to diminishing any of what some law professors have called the safeguards of federalism built
maybe,
into
maybe you
the
should
original
explain,
constitutional
maybe you
system.
Should explain to everybody what the 17th Amendment is.
Yeah, that's a good idea. The original Constitution was in many, many ways anti-democratic. The founders, one of the ironies that
it's what you love about it, Sandy. Our undemocratic constitution.
Well, except that's the title of a book of mine, but it's certainly not what I love about it. But what I do find ironic and deeply ironic about the Tea Party is that one of the things I do kind of admire about it is that it's a real venture into, you know, what I call popular constitutionalism and the notion that we the people can be a living sort of reality instead of a mythic reality that happened once in 1787 and then thereafter just goes to sleep. But of course, if you read the debates in 1787, 1788, you don't find much admiration for popular constitutionalism or popular government on the part of most of the framers. So what I do find ironic in the Tea Party is the cult of the framers, and I think it is a cult, and a certain cult of the Constitution that doesn't recognize that they're really the children of Thomas Jefferson and the rise of little d democracy and indeed populism rather than the faithful followers of the elitists who showed up in Philadelphia in 1787.
Well, I just realized that, you know, the title of your book, Our Undemocratic Constitution, I could write the same book, I could use the same title, and we'd mean completely different things. So yours would be Our Undemocratic Constitution, boo, and mine might be Our Undemocratic Constitution, yay.
Right. I mean, the full title of my book is Our Undemocratic Constitution, : Where the Constitution Goes Wrong and How We the People Can Correct It.
Yay. So, you know, I think it's worth talking a little bit about, use the word popular constitution, the phrase. It's a phrase that was sort of in vogue amongst law professors and legal academics for quite a while. I don't hear it as much anymore. In fact, I predict we're going to hear it less and less if the Tea Party movement continues. But can you give us a little thumbnail sketch of what you think popular constitutionalism really is as sort of an intellectual movement in law schools?
Sure. My first book was called Constitutional Faith, and it was built around a religious analogy in which I distinguished between little p and little c Protestant Catholic views of the Constitution. And one of the distinctions that Protestantism historically puts a great deal of emphasis on individual interpretation, you know, ultimate the priesthood of all believers, and Catholicism, and I don't mean this critically, simply descriptively, puts a great deal of emphasis on an authority in Rome who gets the final say on disputed questions. The cult of the Supreme Court, from my perspective, is little c Catholic. It's the idea that the Constitution is what the Supreme Court says it is. Popular constitutionalism, from my perspective, is a thoroughly Protestant notion which says ultimately that each of us as a member of a certain sort of constitutional faith community is capable of having our own views on how to interpret the Constitution or how the Constitution should be changed to be better.
Well, I certainly agree, and you know that I agree with the idea that the Supreme Court is certainly not, should not be thought of as the last word on the Constitution. And it's the Supreme Court's view of the Constitution, and the Supreme Court could be wrong. Meaning that presupposes there's sort of an objective constitution, not necessarily an objective written one, although I think there is. You don't have to, but there is a constitution outside the court, to use a phrase that Mark Tushnet used.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So we sort of agree about that, and we disagree with those people who think that the Constitution really is what the Supreme Court says it is. And we know there's a lot of academics who have flirted with that position, or they speak sometimes as though they believe that. But then the question I have is, one impression I get from people who are enamored with popular constitutionalism is that somehow it's the Constitution outside the court that changes as popular opinion about what a Constitution should be changes, rather than the Constitution is a written document which has a fixed meaning, although there's a lot of gray areas in it. The meaning is somewhat fixed. And it doesn't change, although people's opinions about it might change. So I wonder, am I right to say, which side of that divide do you find yourself on?
Both sides. In work I'm now doing, in courses I'm now teaching, I distinguish very sharply between what I call the constitution of settlement and the constitution of conversation. Law professors are obsessed with the constitution of conversation. That's the litigated constitution. It's the constitution that involves what Justice Jackson once called, I think, the majestic generalities of the constitution. And my view about that constitution is that there's really not much determinacy to it. That is, there's a wide range of permissible opinion. And where you and I disagree is that I think it's ultimately foolish to say that there's one true view of what the Equal Protection Clause means. On the other hand, in the stuff that I've gotten most interested in over the last several years, the Constitution of Settlement, that's the part of the Constitution that law professors are notoriously uninterested in because it's never litigated. And the reason it's never litigated is because there really is no doubt as to what it means. My favorite single example of the Constitution of Settlement is Inauguration Day, which is on January 20th, about 11 weeks after an old president might have been thrown out of office, because that's just what the 20th Amendment says. And there's nothing to interpret
right
in the way that we ordinarily use that term. My view, as I think you know, is that it's really stupid to wait until January 20th to inaugurate a new president. But I also agree that we can't get rid of January 20th as Inauguration Day, however stupid it is, without amending the Constitution. Ditto with Wyoming having the same number of senators as California, which is worse than stupid. It's a really monstrous feature of the Constitution.
Right. I know you think that, and maybe we'll actually get to that in a little
right
while.
Right.
I thought I would just say what my view on the fixity versus the open-endedness of the Constitution is. I do agree with you that law professors, when they're talking, when they have their theoretical hats on, they completely underestimate the fixedness of what sometimes is called the structural Constitution, the
right
ones that set all
right
the meets and bounds of how the various government actors act. And, you know, they can't say the whole Constitution is unknowable and unknown if they're following most of what the Constitution says without even any question about it. So, and that I think is set by the original meaning of the Constitution. Nobody thinks that that meaning evolves or changes. What we talk about when we're debating the merits of original meaning aren't about, we're not talking about those many features of the Constitution that have remained fixed. We're talking about the more open-ended provisions, or the allegedly more open-ended provisions. And there, I think, number one, that original meaning does provide somewhat more information than non-originalists would allow, either because they don't think the information is there or they don't like what the information says. And they really tend to flip back and forth between those two positions.
Right.
It's not the information's not there, or they don't like what the document says. And then there's a lot of provisions of the Constitution, there are several key provisions of the Constitution that you and I will agree are somewhat more abstract and therefore do not automatically apply themselves to particular cases and controversies, whatever their abstract meaning might be. And then I think that the process of applying these more abstract meanings to particular cases and controversies is not the activity of interpretation, strictly speaking. It's the activity of construction or application. And when the Supreme Court or any court is in the construction zone, or it doesn't have to be a court, it could be Congress, is in the construction zone.
Or a president.
Or the president, exactly.
Or ordinary people, or a local sheriff, city council. I mean,
absolutely. Absolutely.
Right. It's all over the place.
Right. Well, when that's happening, they're not really engaged in interpretation anymore. They're engaged in another activity, and they're not really constrained. They're constrained by what meaning the Constitution has, but obviously that meaning is not enough to get them to an answer, and they have to supplement that with other considerations. And so I think that the key to realizing the limits of interpretation is to realize there's a difference between interpretation and construction, as you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think probably for our audience, this is a bit too much inside law professor baseball, because I think that even if you and I were to agree, for sake of argument, I don't think we necessarily do, but even if you and I were to agree that in 1792, we might have been able to figure out more or less what people meant by, let's say, the Commerce Clause or the First Amendment or something like that. The fact is that we live in 2010, and in between 1792 and 2010, there have been literally hundreds, if not thousands, of not only Supreme Court decisions, but district court decisions, presidential acts, congressional acts, acts by local sheriffs, etc., that have, in fact, changed the meaning of the Constitution. And so I think the challenge that you and, you know, the part of the Tea Party that you represent always has to face is how much of our over 200-year history are you prepared just to junk and quite radically to transform, to take us back to the good old days, and how much weight are you willing to give precedent? And I think one of the things that you and I agree on is that the only really interesting thing about precedent is wrong decisions. That if we're, you know, talking about old decisions, then they're really not that we like. Then it's really not very interesting to say, let's follow this old decision that we like, because why shouldn't we? What makes precedent interesting is where we have a decision where you say, you know, if I had been around in fill in the blank, 1830, 1870, 1937, 1990, I would have decided it differently.
Well, let me jump in here for a minute, Sandy, because I think that now we're moving into a discussion of precedent, and if we've left our audience behind before, earlier, I think now we really will.
Okay.
I'll say one thing about the good old days, just to make clear what my position is. There were previous periods in which some provisions of the Constitution were interpreted better than they are today, but at the same time and in the very same periods, other provisions of the Constitution were interpreted quite badly. So mm-hmm. I don't think that there's a golden age of constitutionalism in this country. In fact, every period you go back and look at, you find gross errors and gross injustices being sanctioned by the Supreme Court of the United States, who are no real heroes if you go back and look.
Right, and you and I agree on that.
Right. So I thought we would talk about a little bit, before we run out of time, a little bit of popular constitutionalism that's emanating from the Tea Party movement, but also from legislators from around the country, and it's called the Repeal Amendment.
Oh, yes, I am very familiar with the Repeal Amendment.
Yes, so let me tell everybody what the Repeal Amendment is. The Repeal Amendment is a proposed constitutional amendment that would
basically
give the
drafted by Randy.
with some assistance from legislative services at the Virginia House of Delegates, and they did some nice little tweaking of my language. At any rate, this is an amendment that would give two-thirds of state legislatures the power to repeal any federal law or regulation. I could read the language, but I have a feeling it wouldn't sound good on television. But it's really very simple. There's no hidden bells and whistles. It's just there's no trapdoors. It just will give legislatures of two-thirds of the states the power to repeal any federal law or regulation. And it is a structural change. Let me just say a few of the things that I think is driving some of the popularity of it. And then I know, Sandy, you have some criticisms of it. But it's a provision that would allow states to check the federal government in a way that they used to be able to do very indirectly and not necessarily so efficiently by selecting their senators. The Senate mm-hmm. was supposed to be a state legislative-driven check on federal power. Well, with the 17th Amendment, that got changed, and it is no longer that check. It's a restoral, it's a restoration of a state check on federal power, and it would be, I think it would be used under two circumstances. One is where the 535 legislators that are inside the Beltway somehow, together with the president, get wildly out of touch with the American people for whatever reason. And I think it would be an unusual circumstance, but it has happened and it could happen again. Then legislators in the state.
Actually, can you give me an example where it's happened? And I mean, if you want to take the medical care bill, you can, because you've really been the leader of the constitutional opposition to it, but even you wouldn't say that two-thirds of the people are appalled by it and that two-thirds of the states would overrule it.
Well, I think you're right. We have no way of knowing whether two-thirds of the states would overrule it. But I do think it's true that it's the only major piece of social welfare legislation passed in the last 60 years that was done on a straight-line party vote with a bare majority and over the opposition at that point of poll numbers, which showed that it really was not supported by a majority of the American people. So, people quibble with those polls, but it's never been the case that major pieces of social legislation, from Social Security to Medicare to the Civil Rights Acts to just about any other act, did not receive bipartisan support. So it is a very unusual bill.
Let me jump in on that, because this goes back to our earlier conversation about democracy. I think that your idea is clever, but basically terrible, as I've been quoted, in the New York Times. Though I also think, quite frankly, as does one of, your general allies in libertarianism, Ilya Sohman, that it's likely not to be effective precisely because two-thirds is such a huge barrier, especially when you realize that 49 of the 50 states have two legislative houses. So what you're really talking about is that you would need to get the support of a minimum of 77 legislative houses.
Of different parties. One party is not going to, never going to control 77 houses.
My math is wrong. In the back of my mind, I'm thinking of what it takes to amend the Constitution. So two-thirds is a little bit lower.
It's 34 times 2, 68.
So 67 minimum.
Right.
And the fact is that's such a long shot. So if you're really, really serious with regard to giving we the people a check on an implausibly rampaging Congress and the presidency, why not follow the guide, say, of the Maine Constitution, which allows the people of Maine, I think it's upon petition, to have a referendum on legislation that is passed by the Maine legislature and signed by the Maine governor, and give their views on it. Now, this happened in 2009. I wasn't very happy about it, given my own politics, because it involved the overturning of a same-sex marriage bill that the Maine legislature passed and the Maine governor signed. But there was a successful petition to put on the ballot. 53% of the people of Maine voted to repeal it, and it's not in the statute book. Now, that's direct popular democracy. And are you kind of for it or against it?
Well, I think I'm against it. Let me say a little bit more about why I think the repeal amendment's a good idea, even though I agree with you and I agree with Ilya that it's only rarely going to be used. I think it could be used, and one of the reasons it's only rarely going to be used is because the circumstance that I just described is a rare one in which Congress and the president are out of step.
I have to say, I think it's a non-existent
one. Let me just add, but there's another circumstance, which is less rare, but also something that would not be something that would be amenable to a referendum, and that is various provisions that get enacted in omnibus bills or regulations that get proposed that really do intrude upon the internal operations of the states themselves, and would allow state legislatures to protect themselves from those. And I think it would provide a deterrent effect like the veto does. It wouldn't need to be exercised to be meaningful.
Can you give me an example?
Well, one that may sound trivial to you, but I'll give you one that might be trivial and one that might be more fundamental. The more trivial one is a regulation that was, I believe, just proposed. That would mandate that all municipalities adopt uniform signage and put new street signs on all their streets that would conform to a particular regulation of how readable they are, imposing millions of dollars worth of cost on local municipalities who would really rather spend that money in other ways. That's one thing. Although, the argument is, they can, if states really care about that, they can get it repealed through the through the legislative process.
Right.
But still, that's one. But a bigger one. And here's where I think you might we might start venturing into your objections on the grounds that this would be empower the minority like the Senate does, which I know the Senate is your most beloved institution in the Constitution. And that is supposing that the profligate states who are dominated by government employee unions and paying them very, very major
pension funds. Yeah, New Jersey.
Right. Supposing that they start to agitate at the federal level to let the other states bail them out. So you have a federal bailout of the popular, of those, of a few very populous states at the expense of other states.
But you know, your example is an interesting one because for better or worse, it ain't going to happen. And it ain't going to happen because of the Senate. That you're absolutely correct. I loathe the Senate, like James Madison. James Madison.
I think you loathe the Senate more than you loathe any other thing.
That's true. I mean, again, yeah. Madison in the 62nd Federalist paper referred to the principle of equal representation in the Senate as a, quote, necessary evil, unquote. And the reason it was necessary is because Delaware and some other small states were basically engaging in extortion. They said, if you don't give us this equal representation, we're going to walk out. There will be no constitution. And Madison actually was tempted to call their bluff, but then he said, no, it's worth it to give Delaware this representation it doesn't deserve in order to get the Senate. It's a lot like slavery. Because slavery was also a necessary compromise for the Constitution.
Well, they both begin with S, Sandy. Both words begin with S, so they do have that in common.
Well, but also in terms of the politics of 1787. But the very meaning of the Senate is that the large states have almost no effective power in the United States Senate. They do in the House of Representatives. So I can imagine your bill getting through the House. There are no circumstances under which I can imagine your bill getting through the Senate. Because if you add up the 10 states that have over 50% of the American population, that gives them a grand total of 20 votes out of 100. So, you know, your problem is just a non-existent problem. And the reason I think your idea is a terrible idea isn't because I'm opposed in principle to the possibility of setting up a check against a national government on the rampage. As I've already suggested, even though I don't like what the people of Maine did, I'm not at all appalled by this check that the Maine Constitution provides or that the California Constitution provides. But what appalls me is the added power you want to give to small states. So that if you said, for example, that a majority of the states with a majority of the population should be able to override a federal statute, I would think long and hard about that. But the point is I wouldn't dismiss it out of hand the way I do dismiss your proposal out of hand, because it leads to the possibility of a minority of the American population, which is wildly overrepresented in the United States Senate, and not so wildly overrepresented, but still overrepresented in the Electoral College. It gives them yet one more piece of leverage that they certainly don't deserve.
Well, I want to address that directly, but before I do, I want to say one virtue of the way the Senate worked out, which is on the other side of the ledger, and I don't even know if you talk about this in your book, and that is that the Senate can't be gerrymandered the way the House can. So in
that's
the House,
true.
You
that's
have
true.
All these gerrymandered districts so that they really are not competitive, and you get a push towards extremism in House districts on both sides, whereas in the Senate, because they cannot be gerrymandered, you actually have to have a senatorial candidate that's going to carry the whole state. And many states have a diverse population, which requires their senator to have a diverse population.
Yeah, except, but here the fact is that it's the large states that have genuinely diverse, fragmented populations. Now, you know, before people from Wyoming and South Dakota, et cetera, get too angry, I realize that they too have a measure of diversity. I visited South Dakota for the first time several years ago and discovered that there's a Spanish language radio station in Sioux Falls because there are a lot of Hispanics who work in the meatpacking industry in Sioux Falls. And frankly, that surprised me. And you know, there are other, and you think of South Dakota also, there's the huge diversity of American Indian tribes. So it's not the case that there's any state in the union that's just made up of absolutely identical people. That being said, what you do find in small states is that they tend to be dominated by two or three major industries. If you want to understand, for example, why we got a really terrible bankruptcy bill several years ago, it was because Tom Daschle, who was then the majority leader of the Democratic Party, is also from South Dakota, and one of the major employers in South Dakota is Citibank.
Well,
and,
can I interrupt?
Yeah, yeah, just, sure.
Because we have about 10 more minutes to go. I do want to address this objection that it would empower a minority of states to...
And a minority of the population.
Two-thirds of the states with a minority of the population. It is a theoretical, hypothetical possibility, but I really do think, Sandy, that it's very unlikely. And I did a little back-of-the-envelope calculation on this point. And if you just take out some of the bluest of the small states, like Vermont, Delaware, Rhode Island, Hawaii, Massachusetts, New Mexico, and Connecticut, you take those people out of the South, out of the small state population, just sort of say they don't support something, and you just add Florida and Texas to get to 34. And mm-hmm. you have the smallest states minus those blue plus Florida and Texas. You're well over 50% of the population.
It's
a hypothetical possibility,
right.
But
okay.
Given the blue state, red state divide, what you'll end up with, the only time this will ever be exercised is if you have a coalition of blue states and red states, and it would just be sheer happenstance if it ended up being less than 50% of the population.
Okay, so why don't you accept as a friendly amendment to your repeal proposal that it would have to be an X percentage of states, 50%, 60%, two-thirds, it doesn't matter, with at least 50% of the national population?
Well, two reasons. First of all, because this, like many other suggestions I've had for qualifying this, would add complexity to the text and the need for interpretation and the need for assessment, for example, of what the populations of these states are. And I'm very, very fearful about adding any provision to the Constitution that's complex in that way or that would that's contested.
I think you're evading because...
Let me give you the other reason is this is more substantive. I mean, that is my standard position. I get lots of suggestions for how it can be made better by just adding this one caveat. And I tend to resist them all, not just this one. But the other one, more substantive, is I think, unlike you, I extol the fact that we have an undemocratic constitution that protects minority interests, including the minority interests of the people of South Dakota and the people of Delaware and Rhode Island. I'm quite content with that. And I would not necessarily be content with minority rule, which is more like what you're complaining about in the Senate. But I'm very content with minority checking power.
Yeah. What I find interesting about your position or the position of people who love the Senate is that with some exceptions, but I don't think that you're one of the exceptions, most of the people who really love the Senate don't, I think, like what is generally called affirmative action. Generally accept the view that equality means that everybody is treated more or less equally as they define equality. But, you know, one way the Supreme Court has defined equality now for 40 years or so, almost 50 years, is the notion of one person, one vote. So what we have in the United States Senate is a spectacular affirmative action program for the residents of small states, because both of us agree that the modern Senate can't plausibly be viewed as a way of protecting federalism.
Well, I absolutely refuse to get sucked into a debate with you of all people about the Senate of the United States. And I also refuse to accept the appellation of a Senate lover. I think I can properly characterize you as a Senate despiser, but I don't love either branch of the Congress. You know that. So,
I have to say, in our conversation today, I suspect that a lot of the people who are, you know, watching or listening in would describe you as being at least generally an admirer of the Senate.
I'm an admirer of checks and balances, Sandy, and I'm very happy that those checks and balances operate to protect minorities as well as majorities. I am not a democratic majoritarianism, and I don't love parliamentary democracy for that reason.
And that you do believe that the very, very small minority of Americans who live in small states just ought to have an extraordinary degree of extra power.
I told you, I'm not going to get sucked into getting debating you about the Senate is like a land war in China. I know how you feel about this, and you're actually quite experienced in debating the merits of the Senate. I'm happier to debate the merits of the repeal amendment or the merits of the Tea Party. But the merits of the Senate are something that I gave you my I stated my views on that.
No, but what I find interesting in all seriousness is that you could probably get a surprising degree of support. Or let me phrase it somewhat differently. You could probably get some surprising supporters for the repeal amendment. If it were modified to be more little d democratic. And so what I find intriguing is that you're really in effect giving up potential support rather than recognize, you know, and you don't have to confront the whole Senate. You don't have to agree with me that the Senate is really awful. All you have to do is to say that generally in the 21st century, some notion of little d democracy really has triumphed, and that you can have a repeal amendment and little d democracy too.
Well, I will say this. Now that I've looked at the census figures and I've actually done the breakdown of the states, and again, it was really very rough and ready, and I see how easy, how almost inevitable it will be that two-thirds of the states that ever would get around to repealing anything would constitute more than 50% of the of the American population, I'm less opposed to including that as part of the repeal amendment, but I also think it's less necessary that it be there. So it doesn't bother me as much, but on the other hand, I think the simplicity and elegance of the two-thirds requirement, which is mirrored elsewhere in the Constitution, is worth preserving.
But again, and here's where you and I disagree, that the Constitution that we live under, or what I, especially what I call the Constitution of Settlement, the hardcore structural Constitution that is almost never litigated, is very much a late 18th century document. And I've come to the conclusion, and you know, you and I share an interest in constitutional history, and I'd be very interested in your response to this point, that I've come to the conclusion that the Constitution we have was in many ways written at the last possible moment that we could have gotten it. That by 1800, for example, with the Jeffersonian Revolution and the like, we had really become a much more little d democratic country. And we simply never would have had the support that existed even 13 years before. And as you know very well know, in two states did not ratify the original Constitution until after George Washington was inaugurated. And New York ratified the Constitution by a grand total of 3 votes. The final vote was 32 to 29. So it really was touch and go. But do you agree with me that for better and for worse, the Constitution really is a creature of 1787 and probably would not have survived the transformation that had taken place even by, you know, a decade or two later?
I do tend to agree with that. I mean, I don't know how absolutely confident I am, but it sounds right to me. And I think that's part of the reason why the 18th century Constitution, as you call it, is unique in the world and beloved, and also why it's worked so well. I think it's part of the American exceptionalism that we have the Constitution that we have.
But
I agree with you that it was 10 years later or 20 years later, it might not have the ideology changed with respect to democracy. To be a Democrat then was a term of opprobrium. It was a criticism, like being a demagogue is today.
All right, that's exactly right. But see, where you and I most fundamentally disagree is, first of all, I really don't think the Constitution has been that successful, that One of the things that academics too often do is ignore a war that killed 2% of the entire American population between 1861 and 1865 that was by and large caused by the Constitution. And that has to be part of any analysis of how well the Constitution has worked or not worked. Secondly, the United States Constitution is not beloved around the world, that it has not served as the model for the almost literally hundreds of constitutions that have been drafted since World War II.
No, it's not beloved. It's not necessarily beloved around the world. It's beloved in the United States. That's why you're such a iconoclast, Sandy.
Right. No, I agree with you. It is the subject of a cult. And what makes cults cults is precisely that they don't examine the objects of worship. They simply worship them. And so here, as you know very well, is where I'm much more of a Jeffersonian. Thomas Jefferson wrote a letter in 1816 or so where he rejected those who treat the Constitution like the Ark of the Covenant. And Jefferson said that we always ought to be willing to ask, to what extent is the Constitution serving us well today? And to go back to the very beginning of our conversation, as I said then, one of the things I rather admire in the Tea Party is their willingness to say, well, is the 17th Amendment, by which requires the popular election of senators and gets rid of states naming senators, did the 17th Amendment serve us well? Now, it doesn't matter that I disagree with their answer, because their question is a thoroughly Jeffersonian question. And I simply wish that more people would ask, not only is the 17th Amendment serving us well, but are other parts of the 1787 Constitution serving us well? My answer is generally no.
Right. And as you know, I'm a much bigger fan of the original Constitution. But I think we can end on the note of our pleasure that the Tea Party people are actually thinking about the Constitution seriously, including those parts that they don't like. What I want to make sure that they keep in mind is that we don't live under the original Constitution, and we should be glad that we don't. I mean, for example, I really, as you know, I'm a big fan of the 14th Amendment. I actually think it's been underutilized, and the people who wrote it, the Republicans in the 39th Congress, ought to be lionized as heroes.
Right.
And they're not. They're largely forgotten. More people know the word carpetbaggers than know the name John Bingham.
Right.
And who, for those people in listening to this who don't know who John Bingham was, he was one of the principal draftsmen of Section 1 of the 14th Amendment, congressman from Ohio. So it's the amended Constitution that I think that has worked out so well, even though I tend to agree with the Tea Party the 17th Amendment, I have to say, this is one thing about the 17th Amendment, and I think we probably have to close. I'm not sure how well it ever worked to protect federalism. It was already being undone by the movement towards democracy that you're talking about.
No, I think that's right.
But it was the idea of it that I think needs to be dealt with. That's what I disagree with Tea Party folks saying. If you just repeal the 17th Amendment, you'd actually get federalism back. I don't know that you really would. I just want to mention the income tax amendment.
Very important.
Depending on whether you think it was necessary that it be put there, assuming that it was, and that's a matter of some debate, I think that has more to do with the growth of federal power than anything else, because once the federal government had all this money, they could start, and once their spending was not limited to the enumerated powers, they could just start doing all kinds of things that were beyond its normal limits, including co-opting states to do its bidding for it.
No, I think you're right. I do want to, and it is time to close, but I want to underscore the importance of the point you made, where both of us agree absolutely, which is that it is absolutely necessary for anybody who professes to be a serious student of the Constitution or somebody who admires the Constitution, etc., to realize that the Constitution didn't stop in 1787, and that, in fact, the Reconstruction Amendments, 13th, 14th, 15th Amendments, as well as some of these later amendments, particularly during the time of creativity, during the Progressive Period, are very, very important, and the 14th Amendment is obviously especially important. I do think that one of the worst aspects of some of the people in the Tea Party, but not only the Tea Party, I think this is certainly true of Justice Scalia, is that you often get the view among originalists that American constitutional history just stops in 1791, and there's almost an embarrassment about the 14th Amendment. And I think one of the things that's really wonderful about your approach to the Constitution is that you're not embarrassed by the 14th Amendment.
No, I embrace it, as you know. And I think that there's a, we don't have time to get into it. I think it's a fascinating story. And I don't think I have a completely worked out answer as to how this came about. But I do think that particularly during the Reconstruction era and then moving forward, the intellectual powers that be didn't like the 14th Amendment. They thought it was too radical, and mm-hmm. they supported the Supreme Court in overturning
right,
it.
Right.
I mean, and that overturning that has stuck around. That ideology that the 14th Amendment was a big radical mistake has stuck around even when the Warren Court started rediscovering the 14th Amendment and right. using it occasionally.
No, I think on that note of agreement, we can wish each other a very happy New Year, and we're going to see each other a week from yesterday in San Francisco.
Yeah, we get to do this all again in front of a live audience of law professors.
Exactly.
Fantastic. It's always great to talk to you, Sandy.
Same here.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.